On this episode of the Ben Greenfield Fitness Podcast.
They're like, oh my gosh, sex, drugs, and rock and roll are going to be the end of civilization. But in fact, sex, drugs, and rock and roll were actually at the beginnings of civilization. Our people are better off, never mind the skid marks, let's get there as fast as possible, is what sets us up for an awful lot of sociopathic solutions and movements. States we've ever had that often appear to be meaningful and can often guide the way into a more courageous life to live.
Health, performance, nutrition, longevity, ancestral living, biohacking, and much more. My name is Ben Greenfield. Welcome to the show.
I get laughed at, maybe because it's a little bit woo-woo, esoteric, invisible, whatever, but I use quantum energy. I pray over my food when I eat. I try and emanate positive emotions and feelings towards people. I do like little breath work and Tibetan longevity exercise moves to charge up my body with invisible energy. And yes, I even blast my home and my body with certain quantum energy products like necklaces and little boxes that I can use to charge up food. And I get this all from this company called LilaQ. Now, I realize that some quantum energy stuff is not provable by science, but Lila does have third-party studies revealing a remarkable 20 to 30% increase in ATP production, a vital process for cells. Quantum energy has over 59 studies already done and counting. These are randomized double-blind studies these folks are doing for blood quality and HRV optimization. I can't explain it, okay? I'm not going to sit here and pretend like I can explain how quantum energy would increase blood energy or blood quality. Could be placebo. I don't know. But all I can tell you is I wear their necklace. I use their products. I blast my home with their energy. And it's called LilaQ. I've got a podcast with them, a few, if you want to take a deeper dive. But you just go to the website. Check it out. It's kind of fun to surf around. And you know what? If anything, you're going to have some cool looking conversation products at your house and hanging around your neck. I love them. LilaQ, LeelaQ.com. Use code Ben10 for 10% off. LilaQ.com. Use code Ben10 for 10% off. All right, folks. Well, cold turkey might be great on sandwiches, but there's a better way to break a bad habit than quitting that bad habit, cold turkey. I'm not talking about some weird mind voodoo from your crazy neighbor standing on a nail bed or something like that. I'm talking about this thing called Fume. This little thing called Fume holds a hallowed place in my fanny pack, actually. Been hitting up the maple pepper core in that thing quite a bit. So anyways, the Fume is not a vape. It's a flavored air device. You breathe natural flavors through it. Like I said, I got the maple pepper core loaded up in mine right now. Turns out black pepper really hits the spot, so I can feel satisfied without breathing in or chewing on anything bad. It's amazing. I've got another one called the crisp mint core, so I can breathe in mint-flavored air rather than a pen infused with something else. You know what I mean? That kind of bad habit that isn't good for you. Instead, you just basically use this pen, and it is an essential oil pen. It's amazing. A flavored air device. You get the taste sensation and the fidget and that hand-to-mouth action, but you don't have to feel guilty about the habit. It's a good habit to have. They have a whole bunch of natural, delicious flavors. It's not a vape. Don't get me wrong. It's a natural air device. It's fully legal. It doesn't have anything bad in it. I even use it on an airplane. I get a few funny looks with people who think I'm vaping on an airplane, even though I'm not. It's just basically flavored air, and it tastes great. I found it made my cravings go out the window. It's weird. It's a crazy life hack, but it works, and it's super sexy and cool looking too. So it's called Fume, F-U-M. You can get 10% off this thing if you go to tryfume.com, tryfume.com. Use code Ben to save 10%. So you can accelerate humanity's breakup from destructive habits by picking up what's called their Journey Pack today. It has a whole bunch of cool flavors, including that crisp mint core and the maple pepper core, two of my favorites. So again, tryfume.com/Ben and use code Ben to save 10% off your order from Fume, F-U-M. All right, folks, you may have heard the recent podcast episode I recorded with this cat who designed a drink. His name is Zach Abbott. He designed a drink that you throw back. It's a little shot, and it digests the toxic byproducts of alcohol for you, meaning that you feel great the next day after you've been drinking. And while I only endorse holiday responsible drinking and responsible drinking in general, it is nice to know you can maybe sneak in an extra cocktail or a glass of wine just because that holiday party is so freaking long. And there's nothing to do but drink. So you throw back a shot of this stuff, and it basically digests acetaldehyde for you, which is the chemical unwanted byproduct of alcohol. And so what they've done is they've bioengineered this probiotic to do that for you. And it works amazingly. You feel great the next day. It's very, very simple. You get a box of this stuff. You throw back a shot of it before you drink. Or if you forget, sometimes people are forgetful and you remember halfway through the party, you just throw it back then. And here's the deal. They've got steep discounts going on. You go to ZBiotics, called ZBiotics, if you're in Europe, ZBiotics.com/Ben. ZBiotics.com/Ben. You get 15% off your first order when you use code Ben at checkout. 100% money back guarantee. So if you're unsatisfied for any reason, because you had 8 glasses of wine, you woke up the next morning and you weren't feeling that great, they'll refund your money. No questions asked. But please don't have 8 glasses of wine. So you go to ZBiotics.com/Ben. Use code Ben at checkout for 15% off. You got to try this stuff. Everybody I've told about ZBiotics, they have literally come back and said, dude, I had no clue. I was skeptical at first. I was skeptical myself, but it actually works. Very interesting. So ZBiotics.com/Ben. All right, folks, he's back. My guest on today's podcast is Jamie Wheel. Jamie just wrote a new book. It's called Recapture the Rapture. And he actually did a podcast with me last year in which we kind of like previewed the release of this book. We talked about biohacking sex and tantric breathwork and plant medicines for orgasmic enhancement. And following that particular episode, my wife and I actually went on a hotel retreat and tried out just about everything Jamie and I talked about in that show. I don't recall getting much sleep that night, but it was certainly quite a bonding experience. Now, Jamie, as a matter of fact, at one point in the evening, we were just so high on life that we left the hotel and went walking around town for about 2 hours and stopped at some random bar and sat out on the patio and enjoyed an amazing meal together. Then went back to the hotel room. So that it was like an 8 hour foray with a restaurant stop and a walk through town, kind of like halfway through. So
yeah, dude, exactly. That's actually one of the best things. Everybody does dinner and a movie or whatever they do out on the town as sort of foreplay. But in fact, if you actually do it, if you reverse it and you do it as afterglow, yeah, you just go out into the world just happy as clams.
It was
and
great.
Stoking out the world. Yeah, it's super fun.
Yeah, it was like afterglow slash foreplay, because then we went back to the hotel after and just kind of kept going. So anyways, though, as you listening in might imagine, Jamie covers some pretty wildly stimulating topics in his books. However, he also delves into a lot of kind of visionary thinking. He calls himself, I believe, a neuroanthropologist. I'll let him clarify what exactly that is momentarily. But this new book finally came out. It's called Recapture the Rapture, Rethinking God, Sex, and Death in a World That's Lost Its Mind. And what Jamie does is he combines this unique flavor of neuroscience and psychology, but then he throws in a bunch of practical stuff like breathwork and movement and sexuality. And this book kind of brings all that together, and it has this basic big idea that we're suffering culturally from a collapse in meaning, and that fundamentalism and nihilism are filling that vacuum with consequences that are affecting all of us. The book is split into 3 sections. The first part is about the coming apocalypse, so to speak. The middle part, which is my favorite part, and to be honest with you, probably the part that we'll focus on most today, is called The Alchemist Cookbook. That's the most dog-eared section of my copy of Recapture the Rapture. And then the final third is called Ethical Cult Building. Now, Jamie also wrote Stealing Fire, which is also a great book, How Silicon Valley Navy SEALs and Maverick Scientists Are Revolutionizing the Way We Live and Work. He founded the Flow Genome Project, and he speaks all over the world. He's in high demand based on his outside-the-box thinking, and he lives in the Rocky Mountains in some off-grid cabin somewhere. I don't know. It's probably something he can't talk about. Because when not riding, he can be found mountain biking and kite surfing and backcountry skiing, and I'm sure he doesn't want anybody to bug him. However, he is being bugged today by me. So welcome to the show, Jamie.
What an intro, and psyched to be back and jamming with you, Ben.
Yeah, word, man, word. Or as we say on my show when I'm interviewing you, not jamming, Jamie-ing. right? Or Jamieing. Okay, so I have to ask you, what the heck is a neuroanthropologist? Did you just make that up?
Yes, 100%. But it gave me permission to do the thing that I realized I'd been doing all along. So my academic background actually through grad school was in actual sort of historical anthropology. So like that was legit amount of training, which is just how do you assess and compare different cultural approaches to the same fundamental human condition across time and space. And Wade Davis, who's a friend and one of my mentors, he's the Harvard entheobotanist and National Geographic explorer in residence and like kind of like a real life Indiana Jones. He said something I think really profound in one of his TED Talks. He's like, we have to stop thinking of other cultures as deficient attempts to be our culture. You know, you have to kind of look at them intrinsically in their own milieu and just sort of and build up from there. So that's anthropology. But for me, neuroanthropology is really taking a look at interesting things that you see around you in the world or that happen in your life and say, okay, that's interesting. Right now, right. Who else has done similar stuff across time and space? And then you start seeing patterns. You're like, oh, we're not the first. We're not the last. How else have other folks approached this? And then you start getting a kind of a pattern language of whether that's belief or whether that's breathwork or whether that's sexuality or whether that's substance use or whether that's, you know, innovation, you know, with technology, whatever, like nothing new under the sun. So you go back and you kind of get a case study of like half a dozen examples, a dozen examples. And that then you can start kind of extracting what are the commonalities. And then the neuro part, which was really recent, like we've only really even had this capacity for the last few decades, is to say, okay, if it's shown up across centuries and, you know, and around the world, there's probably a there. Why does it work? The neurobiological part is what's under the hood. What are the actual mechanisms of action? Because most culture comes wrapped in mythologies. We do this thing because our gods gave it to us, or we do this thing because we've always done this thing, or because your great, 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 great grandpa did the thing, right? But very rarely do we strip out the mythology and just look at and understand the technology. What was the functional mechanism of action? So neuroanthropology is backwards looking, retrospective. But once you get that and you're like, okay, this is the source code of why the things work, then you can engage in the process of culture architecture, which is forward looking. Now that we understand why things work the way they do, we don't just have to bring them wholesale wrapped in their stories. We can actually just bring through the how they work and the why they work to build more effective, more vibrant social and human organization.
Interesting. And it seems like there's also a lot of kind of philosophy woven into your writing and almost like social theory. Was that all things that you covered in college or in university in neuroanthropology studies? Or is that just something that you kind of sprung into being interested in along the way?
Yeah, I mean, I would think that's probably coming out of most of my academic training. I mean, I was all but done on a PhD. Like I'd done all my coursework by the age of 22. So I'd kind of gone lickety-split through that sort of academic system. And then I just got to the end of it and I realized I was actually hopelessly naive about what being an academic entailed these days. And I had to kind of really look long and hard at it and go, oh, actually, I'd rather go out in the world and do stuff than be down in the basement, you know, assessing tax records and, you know, dusty old data. So I kind of came to the conclusion. I was like, oh, I think I love reading, whether it's Guns, Germs and Steel or Sapiens or things. I love reading brilliant people within the disciplines even more than the how the sausage is actually made, crunching a bunch of really tired and dry stuff myself. So I was like, let's go out and live. Let's go out and build stuff, those frameworks and structures of how to look at race, class, gender, environment, belief systems, ideologies, you know, all of these things, and look at how they intersect and how we got to now. I would say that's kind of been a foundation for all my other curiosities.
Yeah, it's so interesting. I mean, like nowadays with spec scans and QEGs and all these methods of quantifying the brain, it would be interesting to say, you know, like go back and see what the prefrontal cortex of the founding fathers was doing, you know, in terms of taking in information and categorizing it and relating it to other pieces of information and kind of see from an anthropological standpoint how much of American culture, for example, is influenced by the neurology of our
founding fathers or something like that. It'd be interesting to kind of like fast forward 100 years now that we do have access to that data, and we'll be able to say, okay, well, here's how Bill Gates and Ray Dalio and Jack Dorsey and Jamie Wheel and Ben Greenfield influenced culture in this day. And I'm totally just throwing our names in there to make us sound like we're amazing cultural influencers.
Dude, we'll draft off that list all day long. Yeah. I mean, you know, an example of a very specific example, just to kind of ground this for folks, is in the study of this book and the preparation to write the section on respiration, I was looking at, how does prayer work, right, around the world? And there was a study on Tibetan, Om Mani Padme Hum, like that kind of classic Tibetan incantation, comparing it to the Catholic Hail Mary, full of grace, the Lord is with thee. And there was parallels with them effectively in training people into alpha wave EEG frequencies, because said in a certain way, you know, with rosaries, right? So you're kneeling, you're staying in front of votive candles, so there's visual stimulation, flickery, dim light, there's smells, there's the smells and bells of incense or candles, there's an icon in front of you, whether it's a patron saint or it's a wrathful or benevolent deity in Tibetan Buddhism, whatever it would be. So you've kind of got a bunch of things. You're even in a sort of what do they call them in interrogation? A forced posture. There's a something posture.
I don't know. I've never been interrogated.
Yeah, exactly. But like kneeling for an extended period of time, like without your butt on the floor and up, you know, is a restriction. It actually changes how you can breathe and all these kind of things. And then you're engaged in a forced respiratory pattern with tactile stimulation. So like offload your prefrontal cortex and executive function. You're now just feeling your way along your mala beads, right? 108 times, or in a Catholic rosary, something else. So you're offloading conscious working memory. And then you're doing a 9-second or 9 hertz repetitive breath pattern, right, which entrains you into 9 hertz alpha wave states. And you're like, oh, okay. So it totally makes sense, given all of those just, again, neurophysiological substrates to what is a cultural, religious, spiritual practice, that, yeah, you can totally bet that the odds are greater than average that something interesting will happen for those folks when they enact all of those things. But there's a substrate that's shared across culture, and you're like, oh, neat. You know, like, this is how we clever monkeys do stuff. This is how we build the layers of our socially constructed worlds.
That's fascinating. Well, you know, my wife and I were having dinner last night out on the porch with the boys, and as we usually do in the evenings, having our family dinner and eating some fish and playing a game. And I mentioned that I was going to be doing a podcast interview this morning, and she said, with who? And I said, with Jamie Will. She's like, well, you know, who is he? And I said, well, we wrote this book called Recapture the Rapture. And she said, what's that even mean? I said, what do you mean? And she said, well, what's that mean? Recapture the rapture. What's the rapture mean? I was trying to explain it to her, and I thought, you know what? This would actually be a great question for Jamie. Like in terms of the whole idea of a rapture, you know, the way that I understood, especially the first part of your book, was that we kind of have woven into human culture this idea of an oncoming kind of like cataclysm or rapture type of event. And it seems that the book is kind of centered around that type of event. But can you explain kind of like the title behind the book? Like, what does Recapture the Rapture actually mean if you're stuck on an elevator with my wife?
Well, I mean, I think the first part is, you know, the most succinct description I've heard of it is Yeats's poem, The Second Coming, where, you know, which is about like, what misshapen beast its hour come round at last lurches towards Bethlehem, right? That one, the sort of spooky one he wrote after World War I. In the last 4 or 5 years, it's become the most searched poem. The things fall apart, the center cannot hold, was like the most searched keyword in 2016. Like the Dow Jones Wall Street Journal did a semantic analysis on it. You know, so clearly it's up for us, right? Like what is happening right now? But buried in like the last stanzas of the poem, he says, the best lack all conviction, while the worst are filled with a passionate intensity. And it really seemed to me in the formulating of this book was like, wow, man, it really does feel like the crazies have hijacked the mic. It feels like there's this huge moderate middle of really decent live and let live hardworking people that just kind of want a shot at, you know, pursuing their dreams and having their kids live a better life than they got to. And, you know, like that's kind of the way it's always been as we're entering increasingly intense and consequential times where our collective, you know, our collective challenges absolutely mandate collective solutions, that we are being led astray, right, by passionately intense minorities. And the question there, so the recapture, the rapture became kind of a play on words, right? It was lowercase rapture. Hey, we're all jacked up, stressed out, isolated, lonely, anxious, depressed, all the things that, you know, folks are facing and wrestling with these days. So we need to recapture our lowercase rapture, right? We kind of need to process our grief and our trauma. We need to remember our inspiration and our highest purpose. We need to connect to each other in high, you know, high trust, joyful relationships. So we need that as a sort of rocket fuel to face the challenges ahead. But then there's also the capital R rapture, which is where are we going at the end of days kind of thing. And can we steer this in a way that forges solutions that work for all of us, not just a tiny fraction of us? And can we do that together?
Yeah, for me growing up Christian, the rapture was always, you know, within the branches of like American evangelicalism, you know, this end time event, you know, when all the believers who are alive kind of rise into the clouds to meet the Lord in the air and the bodies become resurrected. And that's kind of been my own flavor of what exactly a rapture is. But it sounds like, you know, one of the things that it seems going through the pages of the book is that culturally or anthropologically, that this idea of a rapture is kind of woven into most cultures.
Yeah, it's fascinating actually, and I've shared this because I've been so geeked on it. But there's a fellow, John Gray, at the London School of Economics, who wrote a book called Black Mass: Apocalyptic Religions and the Death of Utopia, and he just lays out this thesis which blew my mind. I don't know whether I'm just super nerdy. Maybe Ben, you've got equal geek cred. But he was basically, he just kind of made a very convincing argument that in the West, at least in the Judeo-Christian West, right, we have a very unique version of time. So for all, you know, for almost all indigenous societies, hunter-gatherer societies, and even pre-industrial agrarian societies, right? Time was mostly cyclical. It was the seasons and it went around and around, right? It was Ouroboros. It was the snake that eats its tail, right? And there was a sense of very little forward motion through history and a whole lot of same as it ever was, what comes around goes around, right? And the Hebrew tradition that really instantiated that in the beginning was the word and at the end there's an end, right? The Alpha and the Omega, that broke the, you know, the circular time and then hammered it into time's arrow. The specific contours of that story are really familiar to us, but so familiar we don't realize that they were actually novel once upon a time, which was there was a time back when all was perfect. And that, you know, in indigenous traditions, that's when the animal, you know, we could talk to the animals and this and that, you know, obviously in the Judeo-Christian tradition, it's the Garden of Eden. Then there is a fall, right, from grace that somehow starts history, right? There was a sort of suspended animation in the past, then history begins and there's a fall from grace of some sort. And then there is this moment or inflection point that at the Omega point, the end point, where that changes and then we're delivered to a heaven on earth or off it. And John Gray's point was, he's like, look, that is such a deep groove in our kind of mytho-poetic narrative structures, the stories we tell, that it even shows up in the atheist movements of like socialism and communism in the 20th century, that communism was effectively that identical story, just minus God. You know, there was the idea that we were happy hunter-gatherer farmers, then the fall from grace was the rise of the capitalist owner class, and, you know, man is everywhere in, born everywhere in chains, right? Then there is this redemptive movement of the communist, the revolution in a communist utopia that we all live in, right? Happily ever after. And that could just be like, you know, a sort of nerdy historical sidebar until you look around today. And then you realize, oh my gosh, everybody from techno-utopians, like we're going to upload our consciousness to computers, or Elon's going to give us Neuralink and we're all going to be smarter than AI, or blockchain is going to take over the world and we're all going to be living in super groovy, you know, super groovy independent city-states, you know, and never mind all the countries and all the taxes and this and that, or it's seasteading, or it's, you know, more volatile versions like alt-right identitarians or ISIS or anything else, you realize, holy smokes, you know, or psychedelic new age magical thinkers that we're all going to vibrate out to the fifth density. You know, you've got techno-utopian, you've got magical spiritual, you've got fundamentalist traditional, you've got all sorts of versions, and they almost all follow that same pattern. And the part that's so insidious and tricky is that no matter how they slice it, they're all 1%er solutions. My 1% might be the moral, it might be the fellow believers, it could be the meritocratic, it could be the smartest, the best, and the brightest, it could be economic, you've got a, you know, you've got a $250,000 for a ticket to a space colony, right? Whatever it is, like they're thin slice solutions. As a result, they all kind of share a same four-stage framework. And this is what I would sort of classify as like a working new checklist to say, is there a rapture ideology in play? Which is, the world as we know it is screwed and there's no saving it. Like, it's actually more messed up than it is salvageable. Mm-hmm. There's an inflection point in the near future coming soon, and we can see it from here. We can point at it. We can anticipate it. Might even put a pin in the calendar. On the other side of the inflection point, our tribe, our people, we are actually better off, not worse off, no matter how scary the road to get there is, right?
Right.
And therefore, let's accelerate to get there as fast as possible, because happy days are ahead for us. And it's that the last two, right? Our people are better off, and never mind the skid marks, let's get there as fast as possible, is what sets us up for an awful lot of sociopathic solutions and movements. And so that's really, you know, that was kind of the hot intention of saying, hey, I just kind of want to ring the bell here.
Right.
Is anybody else seeing what I'm seeing? And like, if so, right, we should all be in this conversation together.
Yeah. And you briefly alluded to the idea of calendar again. That's what I think is funny, because, you know, like, I used to walk into, you know, the Christian bookstore in Lewiston, Idaho, where I'd grow up. And inevitably, like every year, there'd be the new book about when Jesus's return was going to happen, or when the rapture was going to happen. You know, at first it was going to be in like 1844, and then like 1981, and then, you know, 1988. And then I think the most recent one was based on astrological theories, like 2017. And fortunately for me, I grew up a little bit more post-millennial and still believe that in terms of the Christian approach to the rapture, that, you know, the entire tribulation foretold in Revelation in the Bible and all of that was kind of fulfilled during the Jewish-Roman War back in kind of like 60 to 70 AD-ish, when Jerusalem was destroyed, and that now the world isn't necessarily going to hell in a handbasket, you know, fast forward into some intense apocalyptic event, but instead everything is getting better and better and better as heaven on earth just kind of gradually comes to life. And, you know, so I kind of fall into the camp of, you know, guys like John Bunyan or Jonathan Edwards or Charles Finney when it comes to the way that I view the rapture or the apocalypse. So fortunately, I haven't had to worry or pay attention too much to the calendaring, because I really think it's irrelevant. But, you know, in the first part of your book.
So wait, go ahead, just so I'm tracking you, because yeah. I've never heard that perspective.
Oh, really?
So you feel like so you feel like the moment was the fall. This was the collapse of the Jerusalem temple, like the rending of.
Yeah, exactly.
That, and that was the moment that like John of Patmos and anybody else was signaling.
Yeah, like Emperor Nero was the beast and like all that. Like basically all of that is in the past, has occurred, has been fulfilled, and now we're already living in this new heaven and new earth that is slowly coming to be, and that, you know, Satan has already been bound, and all those horrific events that we see in Revelation that people kind of equate to, like, you know, black Chinese helicopters and all that is, you know, all of that's bunk. That all of that was just the foretelling of the destruction of Jerusalem.
Okay, and then so your assessment of like, we're already living in the heaven on earth. It's just that for anybody who's not experiencing love and light right now, anybody who's dealing with real hardship and things that you're just saying, but we're on a definite curve. So it's almost like a Steven Pinker-ish twist to millennialism.
Right. The knowledge of the glory of the Lord will be covering the planet as the waters cover the sea. I forget the Bible verse that says that, but I think we're just in the process of that happening. Like people actually becoming closer and closer to God, and love and peace and joy being something that is going to simply continue to take over the planet. And that, like I said, basically the world isn't going to hell in a handbasket. Things are just getting better and better with some obvious speed bumps along the way, but that we don't have to worry about this massive apocalyptic event.
Well, I mean, you know, like I think they've done all sorts of studies, right? I mean, more accurate people are more pessimistic and more depressed, and willfully optimistic people, even if it may be sometimes in the face of the facts, actually tend to do better. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So like that, to what you've just articulated, feels like a very pro-social and adaptive worldview. even if you could go, you know, factoid by factoid and say, is it or isn't it, quote unquote, really happening? The fact that you're enacting it increases its likelihood of happening.
Right. Exactly. I mean, you could take some like COVID, for example, and look at the majority of the Christian evangelical church kind of like, you know, shrugging and to a certain extent, not to paint with too broad of a brush, almost like saying, well, this is the beginning of the end, right? We've got the Great Reset and the New World Order, and it's all happening, and we're screwed, so we might as well just step back and watch this whole thing crumble. Whereas I say, you know, no, this is a chance to cover more people with love and peace and joy, and perhaps a lot of the, you know, a lot of, I guess, the improvements in everything, such as healthcare to telemedicine, to the ability to be able to work from a home office and be with your family more, you know, all of these are actually positive outcomes of, yeah, you know, a briefly problematic viral scenario. But, you know, when you're able to look at life through that lens, I find it to be incredibly, you know, refreshing and almost peace bestowing to be able to have that type of approach versus kind of like an apocalyptic approach.
Yeah. I mean, you know, in ski mountaineering, you know, one of the things we do is like, you know, you tend to climb the thing that you're then going to ski. And on the climb, you're paying attention to everything that can kill you. You know, all the loose rocks, the snow, the depth of the snowpack, what's going on. But by the time you're standing on the top, A, you look around and you're inspired by the view. That's kind of why you went in the first place. And then you click into your bindings. And then on the route down, you completely change your perspective. And all you're looking for is that ribbon of white that you have to stay on and connect, and you completely tune out the rocks and everything that can kill you. Because if you don't and you focus on them, they're sure as hell going to kill you. You know, where your head goes, the body follows, right? So to me, it's that dialectic, right? It's like, can we take clear-eyed looks at situational assessments? And then when it comes to go time, can we absolutely focus on the single path that is success? And let's go hit it.
I get laughed at, maybe because it's a little bit woo-woo, esoteric, invisible, whatever, but I use quantum energy. I pray over my food when I eat. I try and emanate positive emotions and feelings towards people. I do like little breath work and Tibetan longevity exercise moves to charge up my body with invisible energy. And yes, I even blast my home and my body with certain quantum energy products like necklaces and little boxes that I can use to charge up food. And I get this all from this company called Lila Q. Now, I realize that some quantum energy stuff is not provable by science, but Lila does have third-party studies revealing a remarkable 20 to 30% increase in ATP production, a vital process for cells. Quantum energy has over 59 studies already done and counting. These are randomized double-blind studies these folks are doing for blood quality and HRV optimization. I can't explain it, okay? I'm not going to sit here and pretend like I can explain how quantum energy would increase blood energy or blood quality. Could be placebo. I don't know. But all I can tell you is I wear their necklace. I use their products. I blast my home with their energy. And it's called Lila Q. I've got a podcast with them, a few, if you want to take a deeper dive. But you just go to the website. Check it out. It's kind of fun to surf around. And you know what? If anything, you're going to have some cool-looking conversation products at your house and hanging around your neck. I love them. Lila Q, LEELAQ.com. Use code BEN10 for 10% off. LEELAQ.com. Use code BEN10 for 10% off. All right, folks. Well, cold turkey might be great on sandwiches, but there's a better way to break a bad habit than quitting that bad habit, cold turkey. I'm not talking about some weird mind voodoo from your crazy neighbor standing on a nail bed or something like that. I'm talking about this thing called Fume. This little thing called Fume holds a hallowed place in my fanny pack, actually. Been hitting up the maple pepper core in that thing quite a bit. So anyways, the Fume is not a vape. It's a flavored air device. You breathe natural flavors through it. Like I said, I got the maple pepper core loaded up in mine right now. Turns out black pepper really hits the spot, so I can feel satisfied without breathing in or chewing on anything bad. It's amazing. I've got another one called the Crisp Mint Core, so I can breathe in mint-flavored air rather than a pen infused with something else. You know what I mean? That kind of bad habit that isn't good for you. Instead, you just basically use this pen, and it is an essential oil pen. It's amazing. A flavored air device. You get the taste sensation and the fidget and that hand-to-mouth action, but you don't have to feel guilty about the habit. It's a good habit to have. They have a whole bunch of natural, delicious flavors. It's not a vape. Don't get me wrong. It's a natural air device. It's fully legal. It doesn't have anything bad in it. I even use it on an airplane. I get a few funny looks with people who think I'm vaping on an airplane, even though I'm not. It's just basically flavored air, and it tastes great. I found it made my cravings go out the window. It's weird. It's a crazy life hack, but it works and it's super sexy and cool looking too. So it's called Fume, F-U-M. You can get 10% off this thing if you go to tryfume.com, tryfume.com, use code BEN to save 10%. So you can accelerate humanity's breakup from destructive habits by picking up what's called their Journey Pack today. It has a whole bunch of cool flavors, including that crisp mint core and the maple pepper core, two of my favorites. So again, tryfume.com/BEN and use code BEN to save 10% off your order from Fume, F-U-M. All right, folks, you may have heard the recent podcast episode I recorded with this cat who designed a drink. His name is Zach Abbott. He designed a drink that you throw back, it's a little shot, and it digests the toxic byproducts of alcohol for you, meaning that you feel great the next day after you've been drinking. And while I only endorse holiday responsible drinking and responsible drinking in general, it is nice to know you can maybe sneak in an extra cocktail or a glass of wine just because that holiday party is so freaking long. And there's nothing to do but drink. So you throw back a shot of this stuff and it basically digests acetaldehyde for you, which is the chemical unwanted byproduct of alcohol. And so what they've done is they've bioengineered this probiotic to do that for you. And it works amazingly. You feel great the next day. It's very, very simple. You get a box of this stuff. You throw back a shot of it before you drink. Or if you forget, sometimes people are forgetful and you remember halfway through the party, just throw it back then. And here's the deal. They've got steep discounts going on. You go to ZBiotics, called ZBiotics, if you're in Europe, ZBiotics.com/Ben, ZBiotics.com/Ben. You get 15% off your first order when you use code Ben at checkout, 100% money back guarantee. So if you're unsatisfied for any reason, because you had 8 glasses of wine, you woke up the next morning and you weren't feeling that great, they'll refund your money. No questions asked, but please don't have 8 glasses of wine. So you go to zbiotics.com/Ben, use code Ben at checkout for 15% off. You got to try this stuff. Everybody I've told about Zbiotics, they have literally come back and said, dude, I had no clue. I was skeptical at first. I was skeptical myself, but it actually works. Very interesting. So zbiotics.com/Ben.
I would love to talk about this first part of the book, the choose your own apocalypse part, for a long time. However, like I mentioned, I think that the Alchemist Cookbook section is actually going to be incredibly interesting for my audience who are kind of into, you know, all the things you talk about when it comes to like respiration and microdosing and substances and music. And I'd love to delve into a little bit of that, but I'd be remiss not to mention how kind of like funny and creative your writing is. Like during that conversation I was having with my wife last night, I said, like, Jamie's a really good writer. I'm like, babe, even if you're not interested in this book, like, you would appreciate a lot of, you know, like your subtitles, you know, the intertwingularity instead of the singularity, or barbecue your sacred cows, or lexicon for the eschaton. It's like, as I'm reading through your book, I just chuckle at a lot of the subtitles and a lot of, I guess, the word play that's woven in. And so, as an author myself, I'm just curious, like, do you have an actual creative writing process? I mean, are you like, you know, using some of the other elements of your book, like, you know, LSD and prostate massage and whiffing some CO2 carbogen to get you in the mood to write, or how do you actually spark creativity and, you know, and get yourself to be such a creative writer?
Oh, well, thanks, man. I mean, I'm super stoked that landed in the way that it was intended, which is just like, hey, even if these are some somewhat intense or heavy topics, we can and must still have play, you know, still have fun with it. So yeah, I would say, I mean, I grew up in a family where my dad did these crazy complex crosswords, and every other dinner time was a, you know, some Greek allusion or some Shakespeare quotes or this and that. So like, was very much kind of steeped, a little bit like growing up in England, and like our house was like, you know, was built in the 15th century. So there was always ancient around me. There was always like layers upon layers. So I've always been like a etymological geek, like I don't understand a word until I understand its root and its origin and what's the story behind the thing and that kind of stuff. So that was definitely a baseline. On the actual day-to-day, because I mean, most of this book was written during quarantine, and it was, you know, our kids had been shunted back from college. We were suddenly 4 people rattling around in our house again, and I was like, oh my gosh, how am I going to do this? And it was literally like a set of exposed, and I told my editor at HarperCollins, I was like, well, hey, look, this whole COVID thing happens. We've kind of been on like emergency first responder kind of roles for the last 8 weeks. I'm behind on the writing. And she's like, oh no, we're not postponing this again. This comes out spring 21, and you've got to have this shipped by September. So I had 5 months to write 400 pages. And I was like, holy smokes, okay, it's on. And so basically, I got a $500 pair of Bose headphones because I was like, I absolutely have to go into my tunnel. I did a 16 ounces, so a Yeti mug full of shade-grown, organic, high-octane coffee.
Mm-hmm.
And then 2 to 4 milligrams of nicotine gum based on our buddy Andrew Huberman at Stanford, who kind of was just touting the benefits of nicotine, which has never been a part of my life. Brain FM audio entrainment. And mm-hmm. I would just disappear for 3 to 4 hours. And I wrote this book off the top of my head because I was like, okay, I've done all my, I can't afford to go down any more research rabbit holes. And I would just put, you know, TK, you know, where I knew there was a citation from something I'd read at some point and had my research team go back after the fact. And I just wrote off the top of my head. And I wrote 400,000 words in that time. So that's the day-to-day, like how did wow. I kind of quote unquote biohack it?
Yeah.
But to your point on the inspirational stuff, I would say 80% of this book actually came from the place described in the book. This book is actually a recursive hyperobject disclosing how to get to the place where the hyperobject discloses itself, which I know sounds rather abstruse.
Yeah. Explain what you mean by that.
Okay. So my partner and I, 8 or 9 years ago, found ourselves through no skill or intent of our own, being led down this rabbit hole of the practices described in this book. And then the practices described in the, basically the hedonic engineering or the sexual yoga of becoming, right? However we want to kind of phrase that. And for anybody that's interested, in the appendix, there's a study with 10 couples going through this whole experience with lots of their kind of journal reports and all this kind of stuff.
Oh, yeah, where you took the whole, I guess almost like the whole, pardon me if I use the wrong term, but almost like the sexual biohacking section of the book. And you actually kind of did like an internal study with a whole bunch of couples using all of the things that hopefully we get a chance to touch on in a little bit here, and actually kind of like follow these couples along the course of them experiencing many of the elements of the Alchemist Cookbook section of the book.
Exactly. And the total mind-bending thing that I couldn't write in the book because it would just sound loopy or totally pretentious was that like this was actually quote-unquote downloaded to us. Like we didn't think this shit up and it kept on coming through and we kept on having these experiences. And in the experiences of getting into like delta wave EEG, high vagal nerve tone, primed endocannabinoid system, and the kind of basically global system reset of our nervous systems – as we were learning to play with this thing, that's what's happening on the body brain level. It's literally like pressing the power button on your laptop and powering it down and then powering it up. So it's as close to a death rebirth initiation ritual as you can do in the kind of 21st century Western terms, right? But at the same time, you're also having the equivalent of an NDE. You're having the equivalent of a tunnel of light experience,
right?
Which is super rich with content. And the content itself was the content of this book. So like, you know, a few years in, I'm like, holy shit, Jay, I think I actually need to write about this. I think this is the thing. I think the reason we're receiving this thing is to then share the thing and tell everybody how this works. And she was like, you're crazy. Don't tell anybody about this. And then, you know, I'd set it aside for like 3 months or 6 months and it would keep coming back. And I'm like, no, I think I have to. So it was a totally ridiculous path to conceiving and ideating a book. And it was literally, we have probably at this point, 30 to 40 hours of 2 to 3 minute voice memos where we would come back from that liminal space and make a voice recording of the piece that we had just seen or you know, had just sort of been disclosed.
Yeah.
And then that became the structure to the book. So that's a very, you can't exactly share that in a bookstore, you know, or a writer's workshop. But it was so profoundly interesting. It's why that last chapter of the book is, where does the information come from?
Yeah.
Because my sense is in the psychedelic renaissance and in meditative states and all of these things, they often get really fixated on the method they use to get someplace interesting.
Mm-hmm.
But you're kind of like, hey, I think it's the someplace interesting we should be talking about at this point. Like,
right.
What is the Ark of, you know, it's effectively the Tetragrammaton. It's the Ark of the Covenant. It's the burning bush. It's, you know, take your pick of analogies. But where is a place of absolutely perfect, implicate information that appears limitless in all directions? And if you can tune a primate nervous system to be able to receive that information, it is the seedbed of, you know, the Greeks called it the muses. They literally had a sort of divine entity. You know, there's the grace of God and the Holy Spirit. There's, you know, every society has always had some metaphor or descriptor of massively kick-ass information, quite often that, you know, shapes science or shapes philosophy or shapes art, civilization, technology, that was bigger than the person who it came through, and they assign it someplace outside themselves. And you're like, well, what is that? And can we actually start advancing the inquiry in ways that give us better understandings and appreciations of, you know, what I would just, you know, in a super generic term, just call the information layer?
Yeah, you know what? What's interesting, a couple of comments for my audience. First of all, just in case I didn't mention, I'm going to link to all of the things that Jamie and I talk about at bengreenfieldfitness.com/recapture rapture. That's bengreenfieldfitness.com/recapture rapture. But anyways, first of all, Jamie did mention one thing I need to clarify. He used the word TK. And just for those of you who aren't in printing and journalism, that means to come. I don't know why they don't call it TC, but it comes in quite handy when you're writing, and it's an abbreviation that kind of signifies that additional material is going to be added at a later date. It is a huge friend for any author who wants to go deep into writing and not get bugged by, say, like delving into extra research as you're writing something, or you want to write, and it's like you're on an airplane, you're not using Wi-Fi, and you know it's something you might come back to or add additional material to. You just add that TK in there, and it's incredibly convenient. And then the other thing is, you know, when you describe, Jamie, how you'll do your big cup of shade grown coffee and, you know, a 2 to 4 mg of nicotine gum and some Brain FM, you know, if you were an author, you know, alive 100 years ago, it would have been like the cup of cowboy coffee and the cigarette and the birds singing outside. But it's just that simple writer's way of putting yourself into an altered state. And I swear, like, nicotine and caffeine, you know, all other fancy brain stacks and N-methyl peptides and CDP choline and piperine and anhydrous caffeine and everything else aside, like when you step back and look at it with simplicity, nicotine and caffeine are two of a writer's best friends. So I'm right on board with that for some of my own writing.
Well, and actually let me just add one additional thing to the writing thing, because for anybody that's, you know, considering it themselves, et cetera, which was because of the way this information came, you know, sort of into my brain and mind, it was fully formed, and including like the word plays and the puns and that entire vital respiration protocol, you know, all of them, was like, it was ridiculous. It was just like little packets of complete information. And I'd be like, oh shit, that looks fun, funny, interesting, beautiful, whatever. I should really remember that. And that's really what it was. But trained as an academic, I knew the academic case I wanted to make, but I was also aware, I was like, man, this is a pretty shaggy dog story. There's all, you know, this is big. And B, you know, these days we're thumb scrolling monkeys, right? We it's not enough to simply make a compelling argument. You actually have to have plot tension. You have to have something that causes people to turn the page and keep reading. So I looked to Stephen, and I was like, man, the hero's journey is the one that everybody goes to. And as you know, at this point, it's kind of tired, and it's almost, you know, it's like this, like the sort of invisible structure of TED Talks, you know, like everybody's sort of regressed to do the mean. And now even the ta-da moment in a TED Talk, you're all expecting the ta-da moment. And it's just not that, you know, it kind of loses its magic. So I'm like, what is a structure that I can hang? What is a plot structure that I can hang this on? And Stephen Pressfield, the fellow who wrote The War of Art and you know, Legend of Bagger Vance, and he's kind of an inspiration in the field of the art of writing, right? He and his editor have put together something called the story grid. And they're basically just like, hey, there's only something like 10 or 12 stories, and they all follow certain beats. They all have obligatory scenes in them. And if you miss the obligatory scenes, then your reader's going to be undersatisfied. But if you hit them, then the story has tension, it has climax, it has resolution. It feels like a good story. And so I used his framework for what he called a worldview revelation story, which is the way we used to look at the world doesn't work. You then have this crisis. You then have to adapt or explore this new worldview. And if you do, then the new worldview will help you and kind of save the day. But but there's always an ironic twist at the end, which means it's not even quite like the way you thought it was going to be. And so I had the 17 obligatory scenes and conventions, and I laid those against my academic argument, and then wrote the story trying to hang the chapters and the plot points on those obligatory scenes. So that was another just kind of, that's a sort of a structure behind the structure that hopefully makes it more accessible and readable for a reader to actually care.
Yeah, yeah. And I was kind of half joking about the prostate massage, but I believe you get into that in the book, the idea that men have this erogenous zone that allows for an ejaculation-free orgasm that you can just return to over and over again, you know, during the act of lovemaking, or, you know, while you're masturbating or whenever else you might want to orgasm. I'm one of those guys that just like try stuff that I read in books. Correct me if I'm wrong. Did you talk about that in the book?
I mentioned it. Yeah. I mean, it was called the super orgasm, and it was this online community based around this sort of automatic prostate massage.
So it was like peristaltic
muscle contraction. But the thing that was super interesting about that group is it wasn't, you know, it wasn't sort of sexy time. I mean, if anything, it was a sort of a recumbent meditation practice. It was not very rarely even including erection or ejaculation or anything. It was breath work, looping sensations of prostate and vagal nerve into what these men were reporting became these overwhelming waves of sort of euphoric sensation that they were sort of saying is this kind of multi-orgasmic, you know, closer to kind of a woman's orgasm or a spiritual state. So once again, back to neuroanthropology, you're like, huh, what the hell's that about? You know, and then getting under the hood of like, well, why might that have been the case from the physiology?
Yeah. And regarding the latter, that's actually what I wanted to get at. You know, I actually went and I bought one of those, I believe it's called the Aneros, A-N-E-R-O-S, prostate massagers. And I've used it while simply sitting in a meditative position, because as you breathe and as you contract and relax the sphincter muscles as you breathe, and that's basically, you know, kind of like massaging your prostate as you do so, it does actually shift you into, I'm actually not sure which zone I'm reaching. It feels like it's a little bit more theta, but it actually seems to enhance a meditative process. And I tried this a few times after reading about this in your book. And I mean, it actually is really simple, because you just put it in, you know, you get on your side, put it in, then sit up and sit to meditate as you contract. And it actually does allow you to reach kind of like a deeper elevated state of consciousness. It was very interesting. And, you know, obviously, you know, some people might be grimacing at the idea of sticking something up their butt, especially men, you know, thinking of targeting their prostate for a meditation session, but it actually is, I think, worth a try and kind of an interesting tactic.
Yeah, I mean, you know, obviously it's our discomfort with both our bodily, core bodily functions, our sexuality, even kind of varying moral judgments on different substances. And of course, we don't judge them all. We just judge the ones that are unusual or atypical for our community or country or faith. But we've got strong feelings about all these things, right? But if you just kind of reduce us, if you just kind of lop off our arms and our legs, you know, and you just realize, oh, we're just prefrontal cortex is connected to spinal columns, connected to, you know, an ass and genitals. Mm-hmm. You're like, oh, we're just worms, you know, and our vagal nerve, which starts in our brain stem and goes all the way down to our root, is one of the most potent metronomes that sets the rhythms and functionalities of so much of our vital organs and even awareness. And if you can shift and adjust those things, then you can have profound impacts on your state and well-being. And that, typically, the closer we get to those basic evolutionary impulses, respiration, you know, our vital organs and viscera, you know, and things like the vagal nerve and the endocannabinoid system, our orgasmic response, all these things, right? Which, again, we have tons of feelings about, social and cultural taboos about, but really, you know, if you were just a sort of anthropologist from space, you'd be like, hey, humans, here's your user manual, you know, here's how you work, make the most of it. And once you do that, you realize that you can have, you know, basically that notion of how do we precipitate that global system reset, that, you know, which that's the biology of it. The culture of it would be a death rebirth ritual or practice or initiation. And then, you know, and typically you do that by loading up the system and then pulsing a huge amount of energy through that. And that can be breathwork intensification. That can be pleasure pain stimulation. That could be orgasmic response. It could be vibration with sound and music, or even like percussive massage, like Theraguns. You like load energy through the system, create a peak and then a deep recovery on the other side. And then how do you feel? Who are you? And what have you seen or experienced on the other side of that? And you kind of get to come back to homeostasis. You get to come back to 0-0 on your grid coordinates, you know, on time, in tune, in balance, and then just live forwards from there.
Yeah. Interesting. Okay. So now that we've got prostate massage out of the way, let's delve into the five big techniques for achieving a peak state. I think that this kind of like set the pace for the Alchemist Cookbook section. And you talk about getting into this peak state as this state of flow, you know, and obviously, like I mentioned in the introduction, you have a whole book about that flow state, and, you know, Stealing Fire gets into that, and Recapture the Rapture does as well. But what are the five big techniques that you write about for actually getting into a peak state?
Yeah, and just, you know, 30 seconds of preamble as to the why did we select these? There's obviously infinite numbers of different ways to shift states, to achieve, you know, access to the numinous, et cetera. The idea here was saying, hey, if we are trying to recapture the rapture, if we're trying to have a whole bunch of people around the world everywhere wake up, grow up, and show up, like just find ways to, you know, seek inspiration and remember what we've forgotten, you know, heal and mend so we're coming from our most resourced place and engage the world and each other, you know, on a good foot. Then you realize, okay, so solutions can't be fancy and high tech. If you're trying to get to the bottom 4 billion humans on the planet, right, it's got to be cheap or free, and it's got to be open and available to everybody. So then with that setup, you're like, okay, so then it would make sense that if we want to use the longest levers possible to try and move us as humans, and those longest levers are typically as close to evolutionary drivers as possible, because it makes sense, right? If we are hard-coded to do it for survival, there's all sorts of neurochemistry, there's all sorts of rewards and reinforcements to get us to do the things, you know, and other than eating, right? I mean, breathing is right up there, right? If we stop breathing, it's the first thing that kills us. So we have powerful, powerful physiological incentives to breathe. And when we learn to monkey with that, when we can kind of hack in the back door of that panel on respiration, we can totally change our physiology and our psychology. And then you kind of go next down the stack, you're like, okay, and if we don't procreate, if we don't make more humans, then we also die. So that's the next one that is massively, massively encoded. Now, the fact that we have so many hangups and taboos about it shouldn't say, oh, then let's not discuss it. That too should also be a blinking neon sign going, hey, there's a there. The reason every civilization has taboos around sexuality, intoxication, all these things is because if they didn't, they would run the show. We'd never get anything civilized done, right? But sexuality, you know, as Kinsey, Masters and Johnson, John Lilly, all back in the kind of 50s and early 60s, discovered is that our sexual arousal, because it's so foundational, right? Our sexual arousal circuit is it's the bedrock of our entire ecstatic and reward circuitry in our bodies and brains. So if we just live the default version of that, then, you know, our sexuality, our sexual impulses creates tons of trauma, tons of suffering, tons of heartache. And we're just puppets on the string of evolution. Evolution's amoral. It doesn't actually care whose genes pool with whose. In fact, if anything, it flies in the face of monogamy. It flies in the face of commitment and fidelities and all these things, because it just wants a robust, mixed up gene pool. You know, we can say version one of human sexuality is us puppets on the string of an indifferent evolution. Version two could be, hey, let's untie the strings. You know, let's do the Pinocchio thing. I want to be a real boy, right? How can we actually use all of those impulses and drivers not for instinctive procreation, but instead for deliberate integration? And if we can do that, that's fantastic. And then we talked about embodiment. We're obviously all in these meat suits of ours and understanding. And I just took a moment to focus on things that not everybody would necessarily always be talking about. So specifically the endocannabinoid system, pleasure, pain as hotwired circuits, and what is the role and what is the interrelationship between those, the vagal nerve, and the capacities for us to understand what does embodiment do? You know, what does optimizing our bodies and brains do for our minds and hearts? So you've got respiration, sexuality, and embodiment. Those are very kind of obvious evolutionary drivers. But then you kind of throw in two sort of force multipliers, which is music and substances. And interestingly, those might almost seem superficial, you know, compared to the other three. But the moment you study, you're like Ron Siegel at UCLA has established that, you know, intoxication is not just humans. You can't even go back in history to find the point when we first figured it out. It predates us. It goes through the entire primate family. It goes into all, like many, many mammals, from elephants, things, all the way to birds, right? Crows and ravens get lit. So you're like, oh, this is ancient, the desire to shift state as an evolutionary adaptive advantage. And it's clearly not when you're wobbly and cross-eyed and falling out of trees. That's not an adaptive advantage, but the seeking of novelty, the interruption of patterns and ruts, and the kind of being able to jump the tracks and come up with your chocolate and my peanut butter, those are the movements that intoxication. So you're like, okay, that's ancient and essential. Ron Siegel even calls it our fourth evolutionary drive.
Right, that woodchuck wandering around your backyard might have just chewed on some morning glory seeds to fuel with some variant of LSD his shuffling to and fro in an altered state of consciousness, or I would say an enhanced state of consciousness. I don't even like that word intoxication, because it brings to mind that yeah. you're consuming some toxic drug. I really don't feel as though one must sacrifice sobriety, so to speak, or awareness of one's own where one's body at is at in space, you know, as a trade-off to using these type of substances. I think that these altered states of consciousness can enhance, you know, almost like as a microdose might, you know, our productivity or our creativity. And you're right, they are kind of like the icing on the cake of respiration or embodiment or sexuality. But I'd never want to give people the impression that, you know, in order to achieve a peak state, you need to be, you need to consume a toxin, or you need to be in a state that would not mirror, you know, say something close to sobriety. I think that's where a lot of people fear this stuff. They just think, oh, it's a poison that's shifting me into a drunk state, when in fact, you know, it can, but it doesn't have to.
Yeah. I mean, and I think, you know, again, my interest is always kind of popping up a level from the doorways or the keys, right, to the actual what is the view from the balcony. And in this instance, right, I think it's fair to say that what is really healthy is for us to have a full range of neurophysiological and psychological experience, right? And anthropologists call cultures that have just kind of one channel of consciousness, one that's approved, as monophasic, one phase, right? But most indigenous cultures were polyphasic. They had a bunch of different channels. So yes, there was waking state, you talking to me and me talking to you and us making mouthy sounds, right? But there was also the dream I had last night. There was possession, there was trance, there was visions. There were all sorts of other quote unquote non-ordinary means of information retrieval, disclosure, and sense making. And they were valued. And they were integrated, and it wasn't just considered noise or chatter or, you know, or errata, right? And then postmodernism, post French Enlightenment and scientific materialism and all these things, our dial kind of got rusted shut, and we're all yearning for more range. And you can see it even in intermittent fasting. We're like, oh shit, it's probably not a good idea to have 100,000 calories in a big refrigerated box just across the couch from me at all times, you know, juiced with salty, sweetened fat, and I can't stop. So we're like, intermittent fasting, probably not a bad idea. That might even be healthy. How about contrast therapy? It's probably not always good to be just living an entire 12 months in 72 degrees, you know, whether I'm in a box on wheels or in a box called my house. Like, maybe I should get super hot and super cold from time to time, right? I mean, you can see it in the entire biohacking movement. Right, is we are seeking to reestablish and to sort of expand the range of our physical and emotional experiences, because it feels health-giving. And I think within that, you know, that's where the subset category of, and what about deliberate state shifting tools and technologies? Right, because it can be substances and compounds. Oliver Sacks, the NYU neuroscientist, famously said that. He said drugs offer a shortcut. They promise transcendence on demand. So say what you will about them, but they work, and they work within deliberate time windows where you're trying to instantiate the thing. But if anybody has any concerns in any shape or form about exogenous compounds or substances, you know, things that aren't inside me that I ingest, just consider, you know, the tried and true fasting, extreme endurance, physical activity, and or darkness. So, you know, and if you wanted to really combine them, you know, you can do a, you know, 9 or 10 day Vipassana retreat while fasting in silent darkness, and things will get massively, massively non-ordinary. And there's no special whiz-bang tech there other than the old tried and trues. And when ethnologists have gone back to try and figure out, like, what was the sort of shamanic magic potion, you know, of the Greeks or of the Hindus or of, you know, of an African tribe or wherever they're looking. And quite often when they find the plants that seem the most likely candidates, they're often somewhat underwhelming from a pharmacological point of view. Like I feature in the book, right, this tribe in Papua New Guinea that had three plants they worked with. They worked with ginger, tobacco, and then mushrooms, but only mushrooms at the higher level, like ginger and tobacco. You're like, really? Seriously? Like, what's the deal with that, right? But you combine it with a strong and pure and freshly grown and harvested and much higher nicotine content than contemporary tobacco and those kind of things, but also fasting, you know, extreme privation and exertion, you know, you're priming, you know, and all night rituals and all the culture and all the juju surrounding it. And you're like, oh, so this was just one element. This wasn't relying solely on the chemical as the depth charge to get the whole project done.
Right. And for those of you who might think that this book's not for you after hearing Jamie describe a 10-day silent meditation retreat in a cave while fasting, you know, in our previous podcast episode, we talked about this concept that Jamie lays out of hedonic calendaring, meaning that those type of experiences might be, you know, once in a year or once in a decade, you know, in the same way that you even describe, I believe, in Recapture the Rapture, Jamie, the idea that, for example, you know, the type of, you know, intense ayahuasca retreats or plant medicine journeys that people seem to be almost like overusing these days are something that might be reserved for, say, a rite of passage into adolescence or adulthood, and then sharing that space with your spouse on the evening of your wedding, and then maybe on your 40th birthday. And, you know, it's this idea that these are sprinkled, you know, few and far between throughout one's life as these deep immersive experiences, and perhaps some of these other ways to shift into a peak state might be used, you know, throughout the week, such as, you know, chewing on nicotine gum and drinking shade grown coffee while writing. But, you know, don't feel, if you're listening in, as though this is about continually seeking events that just thrust you deep into these altered states of consciousness, because there's definitely this concept that Jamie gets into called hedonic calendaring. And Jamie, you talked about four techniques: respiration, embodiment, sexuality, substances, and then I interrupted you as you were delving into that fifth way of achieving a peak state.
Yeah, good old-fashioned tunes, right? I mean, there's a beautiful Hasidic saying. It says there are 9 levels of prayer. Above them all is song. And again, music can seem like a sort of Johnny-come-lately, especially compared to the others. But Daniel Levitin at McGill University in Canada has written a book called This Is Your Brain on Music. And he and other ethnomusicologists have made a fairly convincing case that There's evidence of music. There's bone flutes from, you know, discovered in caves that are dated at 50,000 years. That, you know, and clearly flutes were not the first. You probably had gourds and rattles and drums and those kind of things, massively predating tonal instruments. And that predates any level of symbolic language and those kind of things. And his case was that was probably actually the way we started to communicate. So pre-complex syntactical language, like what we would think of like sentences with verbs and subjects or objects and that kind of stuff, that we were communicating via rhythm, melody, and voice. And we were using it for essential social bonding and survival. And whether that was staying awake at night through a campfire to ward off predators, whether it was organizing work or hunts or war or any of these things. And that actually, you know, you kind of get this goofy situation where, you know, frightened parents in the 1950s and 60s, when it was kind of like Elvis and, you know, and Woodstock and the Beatles and this kind of stuff. They're like, oh my gosh, sex, drugs, and rock and roll are going to be the end of civilization. You know, it's going to undo it all. But in fact, sex, drugs, and rock and roll were actually the beginnings of civilization.
Yeah, I remember you saying that in the book. That really struck a chord with me, this idea that, you know, we vilify sex, drugs, and rock and roll. And I know there's a whole political movement behind that, you know, everything from, you know, Reefer Madness to the Nixon and Reagan administrations and beyond. But there's this idea that when you think about it, a lot of what you've just described for achieving a peak state, I mean, you know, you mentioned sexuality, you mentioned substances, and you mentioned music, and that's basically sex, drugs, and rock and roll. And those have actually been used to build civilization and bring cultures together and kind of weave humankind along this path to, you know, personal growth or cultural growth. And we're kind of like hardwired to experience those. And in many cases, I guess there's even this idea that farming and agriculture and the emergence of, say, you know, grains for fermenting and everything were all just kind of a way to figure out how to organize around sex, drugs, and rock and roll in a more efficient way.
Yeah. I mean, those are the, you know, and even as far as going back and taking a look at Jared Diamond's research. He's the fellow that wrote Guns, Germs, and Steel. He's a UCLA anthropologist that many folks have probably come across. But he wrote a book, you know, called Why Sex is Fun, and actually makes the case that our human sexuality is actually it's even more weird and of an outlier than our tool making and upright postures. He said it's the third leg of that stool. Like, typically when we think of us going from naked apes to clever humans, right? Our opposable thumbs, our ability to wield tools, our ability to make language. He's like our completely unique sexual habits and patterns, and even physiology, our morphology, what our bodies look like and how they behave and function, is so different than the entire rest of the animal kingdom, including our closest primate cousins. Because you have to consider that the neurochemical priming of repeat, frequent, elective, recreational, year-round sexuality in humans is one of the things that actually changed us and made us Homo sapiens, not just Homo erectus.
Okay, so we've got these five big techniques for achieving a peak state: respiration, embodiment, sexuality, substances, and music. Respiration, I'll tell you the truth. I flipped to that part of the book first, just because I've got such an interest in breath work, and I've been in the, you know, I've been deep in James Nestor and Patrick McCown and some of these other folks, and going through their books also. So I flipped to your breath chapter first. And you began actually by talking about this concept of circular breathing and the use of this didgeridoo musical instrument as a device to learn that. And I'm just curious, have you ever, because I've thought about attempting to learn that, maybe using a harmonica or something just so that I'm annoying fewer people with a giant didgeridoo in the living room. But have you ever attempted circular breathing? And also, can you explain that to folks?
Yeah, absolutely. And the short answer is yes. We learn to play them, but there's actually, you can go on Amazon and there's little super cool, they're maybe 12, 14 inches high, little wooden boxes with two sound chambers in them. So you can learn to play a didgeridoo with this little thing that fits in a laptop bag.
Do you know what it's called?
Gosh, I mean, literally do like didgeridoo box or something like that. Okay. And if not, I can send you the link in the show notes. Yeah, yeah, because ultimately humans, we learn best by play, right? And so given any form of something that is engaging, frustrating, satisfying when you get it, and then you can tweak it and learn more and keep going kind of thing, like that's how we really acquire sustainable skills. One of the things that intrigued me was the Karolinska Institute in Sweden, the folks who award the Nobel Prize and that kind of stuff, are also cutting edge research institution. And, you know, probably 5 years ago, they released a paper on nitric oxide production, which is a neurotransmitter that crosses the blood-brain barrier, and it sweeps away, you know, stress and arousal chemicals and introduces what Herb Benson at Harvard called the bliss molecule, right? It sort of introduces all the groovy things of nice peak states. So it's a very helpful and very effective neurotransmitter. And the Karolinska Institute folks found that when you breathe and vibrate your sinus cavity, so when you breathe out through your nose and vibrate your sinus cavity at the same time, so that kind of a thing, you increase nitric oxide production in your brain by 15 times, which is insane, right? That's this ridiculous performance booster. And then I was like, that's interesting. So on the one hand, you can do your yoga or you can do your sitting meditation and you can be humming while you breathe. Great. So mildly embarrassing, you know, but still decently effective. And I'm like, wait a second. That is exactly what you have to do when you're playing the didgeridoo, because it's this long tube. It looks like something out of Dr. Seuss, right? This kind of like wooden trumpet, and you blow on it. But then the way, you know, both trumpet players like Louis Armstrong, but also indigenous didgeridoo players learned was if you kind of blow out your cheeks like a bullfrog and you get to the, you know, you blow outward until your lungs are almost empty, but you've got that extra pocket of air in your cheek, and then you can squirt that air through your lips while you're simultaneously sniffing. So you're sort of forever squeezing and sniffing at the same time. And it's this kind of goofy, herky-jerky motion. But once you get it down, you can effectively keep playing continuously for as long as you want. And then so that was where I was like, wait a sec, I bet that you take that new Karolinska Institute research on nitric oxide production, which then tends to put you into a trance state. You have the vibration of that wooden trumpet, the didgeridoo, and you have perpetual forced rhythmic circular nasal breathing. I bet that does a thing, doesn't it? And then you go and research and you look and you're like, oh yeah, that's exactly how Aboriginal elders would play themselves into dreamtime. And they would then enter sort of this non-ordinary state of information access, et cetera. And as soon as you started, you know, as soon as we started combining all the research, you're like, wow, that is an ancient neurotechnology for trance induction and traveling. And it's as simple as making music with a very specific and unusual breathing pattern.
Interesting. You know, I'm going to have to get one of those little boxes and give it a go, because it's always been on my radar to try this circular breathing, just because I've seen some of the same research on things like nitric oxide production that you bring up in the book and that you're just talking about. But
a simple fun way is just grab a drinking straw and try and blow perpetual bubbles into a glass of water. And you can just do it, and you can just do it by blowing out your cheeks. We actually do these in workshops and stuff to give people progressions on how to become like what is respiratory mastery. And that's one of the really fun ones that you can do. Simple practice.
My twin sons and I are going to have fun now. Straws are getting broken up tonight. The giant curly straws. Yeah. Oh yeah. all right. So related to that, because I want to talk about a few things that maybe folks don't know about when it comes to breathing and gas in general. Meduna's mixture. What is that? And why did you write about that?
Yeah, it really was. It was a total accident. Roger Walsh, who's a MD, PhD at UC Davis, and he was one of the coiners of the term transpersonal psychology. He's been kind of one of the guiding lights of that generation of sort of academic elders. And he's actually responsible for that, cueing me on to that monophasic and polyphasic distinction about cultures and their ranges of consciousness. But he actually gave me a copy of his book, Higher Wisdom, and it was a series, it was basically like an oral history of the first wave of psychedelic researchers. So the sort of Stan Grof in like the 1950s to early 1960s, you know, before even Ken Kesey and things get, you know, wacky and weird for sort of the electric Kool-Aid era. So like back when it was, you know, when Sandoz LSD was a research chemical, when it was at UCLA, it was in Manitoba, it was at Stanford, it was all, you know, completely rigorous and above board places. And at first I was like, thanks so much, Roger. You know, I'm deeply appreciate, but I think I kind of know all these stories. You know, I kind of did my diligence back in my 20s, and I kind of sat on my shelf for a while, and then I pulled it off, and it just flipped open to a chapter of somebody I hadn't heard of. And suddenly they were describing that in the like late 50s up in Manitoba, they were using this other thing called Meduna's mixture as a screening tool. They were having people breathe this gas blend, and they were using it as a screening tool to check to make sure someone wasn't going to freak out when they actually did the proper LSD sessions. And it was from Ladislav Meduna, who was a Hungarian researcher at the same time that Stan Grof was still over there. So before Stan Grof had even come over to the States and plugged in at Johns Hopkins. And Meduna had been using this mixture to try and create basically a sort of respiratorily induced epileptic seizure, like a grand mal seizure, because he was hoping that, you know, and this is the era of electroconvulsive therapy, like, you know, jumper cables to the brain and that kind of stuff, because everybody realized that, I mean, they were barking up the same tree we're talking about, which is how do you induce a global system reset? And if you can, it seems to help or, you know, resolve or ameliorate a host of different conditions, from epilepsy to bipolar to you name it, right? When we have those moments of coming back to zero, where we often start better than we were. So that's what Meduna was trying to use it for. And that never quite panned out. But the LSD researchers, including Graf, realized, wait, when you do this, and it is a, let's think, what's the ratios is, it's 70% oxygen,
okay,
30% CO2. I mean, it ranges, but like when people say Meduna's mix, that's typically the ratio they're referring to. So it's, you know, if atmospheric oxygen, you know, air has roughly 20% oxygen, then you're looking at sort of 3.5 times the O2 you actually need. So you're massively, massively oxygenated. Mm-hmm. But, you know, when we exhale, we have what, roughly 4% CO2, you know, so you're like, you know, and instead you're getting 30% CO2. So way more carbon dioxide than your brain is used to registering. It gives you this paradoxical situation where you're safe as houses. You've got more O2 to the brain than you ever would on a month of Sundays. And yet you have this absolutely overwhelming sense that you're dying of suffocation.
That simultaneous increase, though, in carbon dioxide and oxygen is something that's kind of difficult to attain. Most forms of breath work, you're breathing off CO2, retaining oxygen, or vice versa. It's pretty uncommon to be able to retain both high levels of CO2 and oxygen. But this idea of inhaling, and there are even devices. If you Google Carbogen, you can find, I think it's like a $400 device that comes prepackaged to your house. You can actually wear a mask and breathe this stuff. And that idea of exposing yourself to that shifts what's called the Bohr curve in physiology, kind of to the right. You get more oxygen dumped off into tissue. But what's interesting, and I think I talked with James Nestor about this, is training the body to be able to tolerate those higher levels of carbon dioxide, kind of like a cold bath, increases stress resilience and the production of both heat shock and cold shock proteins to induce greater cellular resilience and resilience to stress overall. You know, the high levels of carbon dioxide in the bloodstream can do the same thing. And I believe that breathing this type of mixture is actually being used to do things like treat people's anxiety or allow them to deal with anxiety more efficiently.
Yeah. And the thing that had prompted me to go down this rabbit hole in the first place was that the subjective reports of several, like in one book, I think I came across it three different times in three different chapters, was that patients who had been breathing the Carbogen as a screen for the LSD had then gone back and said, you know, I did both, and I think I actually got more out of the Carbogen. Like, I had more profound insights. I had more, you know, more non-ordinary state experience, et cetera, than from the LSD itself. And that was back in the day, right? I mean, this was Sandoz finest pharmacological grade and high dosage LSD. So like nothing to sneeze at. And it was just CO2 and oxygen was doing even more. So to me, that was a fascinating inquiry, because once again, you know, that there is a little bit, I always kind of, I mean, it's a goofy analogy, but I think of like professional wrestlers, right? Where, you know, like WWE, is it E or F?
I think there might be both.
Well, in any event, like right when they're about to go and do a super huge move, they go running into the ropes and stretch them like rubber bands, and then use that rubber band stretch to come back and launch, you know, a pile driver onto their opponent, right? My sense is that with all of these protocols, there is a degree of heading in the opposite direction of where you're trying to get. You load the system, right? And so if you're trying to get to a really calm, integrated reboot, you actually go shoot the moon. You do that, but one of the best ways to do that is by cultivating the most intensive peak experience possible, and you can then sequence these. So the project we're working on right now is to actually sequence this gas-assisted protocol, and you start with this Carbogen, and then light and sound that is off, you know, understandably scary, oppressive, you know, dark imagery, sad, you know, discordant music, all of these things while you're breathing Carbogen, because that's the one that makes you feel like you're being buried alive, to the point where you literally get to snapping, can't take it anymore. You dissociate into, you know, I've just died. I've given up the ghost in some way, and then seamlessly transitioning into like celestial euphoric. The gas blend then shifts to nitrous oxide and oxygen blend.
Nitroxygen, I think you call it in the book.
Yes.
Literally like the whippets that we talked about in our other podcast that you can use, you know, for sexual enhancement, literally like, I guess that's what they're called, whippets, where you use the little whipped cream canister, cartridges and the balloon. And is that what you guys are using to deliver the nitroxygen?
No, I mean, we'd use medical grade gas splitters. So you can actually,
oh, you're so professional.
The ratios and those kind of things. I mean, the challenge with any time you're inhaling a pure gas that doesn't have oxygen, it is no surprise, hypoxia. I would say it's not advised, and certainly not to be misused. But yeah, with a gas splitter, you can dial the ratios, and the strongest ratio you can do, they have sort of set points on them, is 70-30 nitrous oxide to oxygen. And that's still ensuring, you know, 150% oxygenation over anything else you'd be doing.
Okay, so that's basically like the vital respiration protocol that you talk about in the book, combining carbogen and then doing nitroxygen.
Yeah, and with static apnea, right? So then you're doing the, you know, full inhalations and maximum breath holds, and then seeing how long can you remain in that space without thinking. And what the nitroxygen does is it shunts you for 3 to 12 minutes into double amplitude delta wave EEG activity, which is A, very rare. Usually we only enter delta in deep dreamless sleep. B, double amplitude. This was discovered at MIT by a team of anesthesiologists. They're like, what the hell? Like, we've never seen this. We didn't expect this. And this appears to be a thing. We were working backwards from knowing that the experience delivered these transcendent repeat insights. So we're like, we know there's a there. Now these guys are telling us what the mechanism of action is. Oh shit, it's double amplitude delta. And interestingly, the brain normalizes and adapts. You can't just go camp out there for hours at a time. Like after that 3 to 12 minutes, you go back to baseline and potentially kind of alpha beta, and you lose access to that information because it's only disclosed down in delta, and you get back up into conscious waking state, prison house of language territory, and it slips through your fingers, which is what, you know, William James and Winston Churchill commented on back in the day. So, and then, you know, you're like, okay, Now we've got our, you know, the same way like carbogen was this like sort of, you know, like rabbit hole to go check out. And you're like, oh, fascinating. There's a there. The same thing with these delta waves, because that MIT study did it, right? We knew from Herb Benson's work at Harvard that nitric and nitrous oxide had this some form of interrelationship and some contribution to peak states, neuronal signaling. And then Carl Dicerot at Stanford did something with ketamine, found that was 3 hertz, which is within the delta band as well. And if you think about it, right, 0.1 hertz to 4 hertz is the delta wave. That's the lowest EEG. Below 0.1, you're effectively brain dead. There is no neuroelectric activity, right? So we are right on the doorstep of a near-death experience. And what folks have found with the antidepressant benefits of ketamine, the antidepressant and anxiolytic effects of nitrous oxide, you pretty much anywhere you look, they're like, oh, it appears to intercept the hypothalamus and create a brainstem reset. You know, it affects the brainstem. It stimulates the brainstem. The stimulation of the brainstem seems to correlate with the EEG signature of delta wave states, right? And what Dicerot at Stanford found was, he's like, okay, ketamine seems to benefit people for depression because they have a dissociative or out-of-body experience, and that stepping outside yourself appears to help you when you come back to yourself. Okay. Then he found that it was 3 hertz signature in certain locations in the brain. Then he went back and electrically stimulated 3 hertz without the ketamine. So no drug intervention, now just electrical stimulation of the brain, now that we know what it did. And the same dissociative experience happened. They had the same out-of-body state and the same positive benefits to their mood and well-being. So now you're like, okay, so that vital respiration protocol, and really even all of this hedonic engineering, can become, oh, how do we do everything possible to let a person who's tired, wired, and stressed, who's, you know, jacked up, messed up, all the things, we're carrying the burdens of life, we get to have an experience that both charges us up, so builds lots and lots of energy in our system, releases it in a blissful white light, you know, culmination, and then lets us ride that wave, double amplitude, delta EEG, brainstem reset, high vagal nerve tone, right, and full discharge and reboot.
Yeah.
And even if it was content neutral, even if it was just like white noise static that whole time, you'd wake up feeling like $1 million, right? Like, woo, boy, oh boy, I just feel like I just had my, you know, like a Jiffy Lube oil change, 15-point inspection. I'm ready to go. But it's not neutral. it's usually some of the most profoundly inspired and epiphanic states we've ever had that often appear to be overwhelmingly meaningful and can often guide the way into a more courageous, higher integrity, more creative, more effective life to live.
And by the way, I should caution people, you know, alcohol is one of the best ways to reduce delta wave activity. So you'd never want to combine this, preferably with any form of alcohol. But one thing I do know that actually increases delta wave EEG activity that I don't think you mentioned in your book, but it would be interesting to kind of toss this into the equation, is there's an injectable peptide many people use to enhance deep sleep called delta sleep-inducing peptide. And literally, as the name implies, it induces delta wave EEG activity. And that would be interesting to kind of see how that plays into the nitroxygen, carbogen breathwork mix that you just described, to see if you could shift it just a little bit more into delta wave state. So
have you checked that out at all? Have you tested it against?
I haven't tried. I mean, I've used the delta wave peptide, or the delta sleep peptide, but I haven't combined it with that. And I've only used it for sleep, not for altered states of consciousness. So it'd be something interesting to try, or it'd be something interesting for one of our listeners to try and perhaps just leave comments over in the show notes. You know, one other thing regarding breath that you talk about that I think it's going to be interesting for people, because I'm actually working on an article right now about nootropics and how to kind of blend different nootropics to accelerate or break neural activity, you know, such as if you were to say, like, overdose on a microdose of LSA or LSD for productivity, how to combine things like L-theanine and creatine and Bacopa monnieri or black seed oil, you know, some of the things that actually kind of break the excitability or irritability that might occur from overconsumption of something one might consider to be an upper or an accelerant. You actually get into the same type of concept regarding breath. You kind of lay out acceleration and braking and steering. And I'd love for people to hear a little bit about what that actually means, like how you could use something as simple as breath to accelerate or to brake or to steer one's psyche.
Yeah. I mean, the intent there was that, you know, I think there's a lot of, there's a lot of sort of interest, but also hype and false complexity as people are getting into breath work these days, you know, and just to try and really, really ground it, which is basically saying, hey, you can kind of upregulate how you're doing. You can add more pep or juice to what you do. That would be the acceleration. You can downregulate how your body and brain are feeling. So, you know, you can basically take a little heat off the ball. So if you're feeling stressed, agitated, those kind of things, you can meaningfully slow yourself down to a more autonomic, receptive, sort of parasympathetic state. And then you can also kind of transgress what you're doing. And that would be the steering. Like, can I go someplace else? Can I see what another way of being alive and receiving information feels like? We kind of know just intuitively examples of all that, right? So that, you know, you can, I mean, a classic one is sort of Tony Robbins bouncing up and down on his mini tramp and huffing and puffing, or, you know, Michael Phelps, you know, breathing fast and slapping his back before stepping up on the blocks. You're like, okay, I'm getting ready to do a high energy, high output, high consequence thing. You know, or ski racers in the gates where they puff and they bang their poles together. I like that. That is an upregulation technique. The opposite could be, you know, or I'm going on that stage and I'm scared out of my mind. So I take a few slow breaths and I'm really trying to seethe myself down, or or I'm walking down the aisle, or Lamaze breathing, right? I'm trying to actually dump energy from an aroused and stressed system. And then there's the steering or transgressing states of consciousness. And you alluded to them earlier, Ben, but, you know, hyperventilation in some combinations with breath holds is a very effective way of exploring different states. And it's because it blows off CO2, it pushes our blood into the alkaline pH, and that has all sorts of knock-on effects to consciousness. Once you realize that, you're like, I'm in charge of my consciousness. And I'm in charge of it with my hand on the lever, which is as simple as it could possibly get, which is, what is the rate, depth, and rhythm of how I cycle air through my body and lungs?
Yeah, it's kind of similar to something like using because I actually do this, like a Wim Hof protocol prior to a really cold ice plunge, you know, doing the entire inner fire pranayama-esque breath up, which would be an accelerant. And then once any dizziness has subsided, shifting to the cold tub is straight into a box breathing protocol. And that would be an example of like an accelerant followed by, you know, box breathing is a little bit of, it's kind of like a combination of braking and steering to a certain extent. Although I consider steering to be something I would use more for like a meditative or a plant medicine experience where, you know, especially for some deeper plant medicine journeys, you can usually use your breath as fuel to actually literally steer you into different places. But this idea of recognizing that breath is not just for relaxation, not just for de-stressing, nor is it just for amping ones up, but can be used as both an accelerant and a brake and as a steering mechanism is something that you unpack in the book. And I thought that was super interesting and something that a lot of folks probably don't think about. Now, I know we're running a little bit short on time, but you've mentioned a couple of times that you do like workshops that you have people, you know, come in and try some of these things or learn from you. Is that something that you do out there in the Rocky Mountains in Colorado? Do you travel and put on events or if somebody actually wanted to work with you or with your team, how does that actually work?
Yeah, we're doing one in the mountains near Aspen in Colorado in a few weeks' time. That's unfortunately all full up. But then we do other things for groups like YPO, and we also do adventure courses in Utah, in Baja. We basically kind of try and follow the hydrologic cycle of the seasons, right? So the snow falls in the mountains and we can do like ski mountaineering and leadership things. Then the snow melts and it goes into, you know, into the aspen groves and we do kind of like hot, you know, midsummer gatherings. And then it flows down into the rivers and the canyons and we go canyoneering and adventuring in the fall. And then it pumps out to the Sea of Cortez and we do, you know, kite surfing and free diving and those kinds of things in Baja. And that's our sort of cycle. You know, we just kind of follow the seasons. For flow camp this summer, you know, we're also doing pretty much everything written in the book, right? Which is martial arts with an Aikido master who actually trained SEAL Team 6 as well as Tony Robbins, you know, deep body work, acro yoga, you know, Theragun massaging, all sorts of things for bodily integration. We're doing intellectual in theory, but we're also doing percussion. The band Rising Appalachia is going to be there. We're doing everything from gospel church karaoke, you know, like singing the American songbook joyfully together, but also learning group percussion as an, you know, an entrainment and group flow tool. Then culminating in the middle of the week where they, you know, and then doing breath work, static apnea, pulse oximetry, personal scores, measurement, et cetera, and then working with Colorado physicians to do a research project, quote unquote, right, where everybody gets to participate in additional layers of breath work plus wearable base like sub packs, Theragun massage, partner spotter, cannabinoids, so edible cannabinoids, you know, in the state of Colorado, which is recreational and available, into the gas-assisted nitroxygen and carbogen, and then potentially on, you know, specifically in, you know, inducted patient doctor prescribed oxytocin and ketamine nasal spray. So now what we can do is you can do the synchronized consumption of prescription pharmaceuticals and over-the-counter compounds in combined with stacked protocols, doing all the other stuff, the breath work, the body work, the music, the sound, the lights, to create basically celebratory church. So it's sort of, instead of BYOB, it's, you know, BYOE, like bring your own entheogens. Right. Mm-hmm. Everybody is doing something that is not underground. It's completely sanctioned and above board. Each round gets increasingly intense, but the intention is not to sort of go cross-eyed and drooling. The intention is what might a postmodern, contemporary, celebratory sacrament look like these days? And can we create one that is using household materials and yet nonetheless gets us to where we're hoping to go, can deliver insight, healing, and connection, and can reaffirm our both collective and individual desire to, you know, step up and show up and what's ours to do.
Yeah. Well, that's especially cool for those self-experimenters and psychonauts who don't want to mess around with this stuff at home and want to learn it from the experts. Going to a workshop like this would actually be, I think, pretty helpful to be able to gather more information and experience some of the practical aspects within the book and some of your other teachings and writing. And we really just for you listening in, like Jamie and I scratched the surface on some of the stuff that I wanted to get into. But I mean, this book is one of those books that I took a while to get through just because every page has some super interesting information and also just big vision thinking in it. And so I would recommend that you give it a read. It's called Recapture the Rapture. And I'll link to it and everything that we talked about at bengreenfieldfitness.com/recapture rapture. But worth a read. And I'll also link to the other podcast that Jamie and I did about this whole idea of enhancing sexual experiences using, again, a lot of the tactics and the hedonic sex matrices and things like that, that he outlines within the book. So, Jamie, you hit it out of the ballpark with this thing, and kudos for writing it.
Oh, thanks, man. I mean, you know, it just felt like, it was a swing for the fence kind of play, but I hope that it can support people. Cause if, you know, the simplest would be, hey, you're not crazy. The world's kind of gone a little crazy. And giving us just acknowledging that so that we're not beating ourselves up. You know, next, realizing, hey, there are ways to remember, you know, to find that loving feeling that we might think we've lost. And there are ways for us to get back up on our feet. And there are ways for us to reconnect with each other. And oh, by the way, you know, if it ever feels like this world's a little overwhelming, if you had a choice of which movie you'd show up in, wouldn't it be Star Wars? Wouldn't it be Harry Potter? You know, wouldn't like we're hardwired for those stories of like, you know, tiny little bands of rebel misfits at the 11th hour saving the universe from unspeakable evil, right? The Hobbit, all of them, right? We love them. And so like, what if we're born into that period in history where it's go time, where it's guts ball, and we've been blessed with the tools to get the job done? So you said read the book, but I'd even encourage folks listen to the book, because I actually got to read it myself during that crazy snowstorm that shut Texas down in the beginning of the year. And feedback has been that that is a much higher bandwidth communication than just the words on the page. So if you have the choice, definitely check out the Audible.
Does it come complete with like the sirens and the shouting and the mass panic from all the Texans freezing their asses off at 50 degrees?
Dude, it was just so quiet in our neighborhood. Nothing happened. It was perfect cocoon time.
I love it. All right. So cool. The audiobook's available to everybody, and I'll link to that in the show notes as well. So, Jamie, thanks so much for coming on the show, man. It's as usual, a pleasure talking to you.
Always been. And really, really psyched on all the overlaps in our life and our inquiries and our community. So I hope this lands for you guys listening as well.
All right, folks. Well, I'm Ben Greenfield along with Jamie Wheel, signing out from BenGreenfieldFitness.com. Have an amazing week.
Well, thanks for listening to today's show. You can grab all the show notes, the resources, pretty much everything that I mentioned over at BenGreenfieldFitness.com, along with plenty of other goodies from me, including the highly helpful Ben Recommends page, which is a list of pretty much everything that I've ever recommended for hormones, sleep, digestion, fat loss, performance, and plenty more. Please also know that all the links, all the promo codes that I mentioned during this and every episode help to make this podcast happen and to generate income that enables me to keep bringing you this content every single week. So when you listen in, be sure to use the links in the show notes, use the promo codes that I generate, because that helps to float this thing and keep it coming to you each and every week.